He is risen. Okay, just checking. Because I recently heard a pastor say that it's hard to sustain the enthusiasm of Easter. My initial response was, this is not good. But as I've thought more about it, it's occurred to me that after the hype and splendor of Resurrection Sunday, maybe it can feel a bit now like we've been dropped alongside the apostles to wade through the rest of the story, to wonder what's next. And so I wonder if it's there that we sometimes feel that hesitation in our enthusiasm. It probably doesn't help that today is known in the Christian year as Doubting Thomas Sunday. Can we just talk about that for a minute? Thomas's title, how did he get this rap? I mean, I know the story. We heard it read wonderfully. We're gonna get back to that in just a minute. But seriously, who thought it's a great idea to take this guy's worst moment and then use it to define him for all of history? How would that play out for you? And furthermore, do we refer to Peter generally as denying Peter or Mary Magdalene as Mad Mary? I don't think so. So how does Thomas get stuck with his identity coming from this one moment, this snapshot in his journey with Christ where his humanity is in full bloom, and suddenly he carries with him this terrible title for the rest of his existence? Maybe it's just an inner sense of justice rising up in me, or perhaps the way I sustain my Easter enthusiasm is by getting a little feisty on the second Sunday of the season. But as I've been thinking about it, I've started to wonder if this title that we give to Thomas really serves as a window into our own discomfort with doubt, into our unease with questions about difficult things, things that are perhaps impossible to explain or that require a divine depth of understanding in order to accept. I admit, doubt feels a little awkward to talk about just one week following the celebration of Christ's resurrection, because Easter is a season where we celebrate themes of new life and joy, victory and redemption, where we seek to lean into the dawn as we were challenged to do last Sunday, and where we live into the day of the Lord as Easter people. But if we read the Easter account very carefully, it's pretty hard to deny that doubt is also a recurring theme of this story. Mark tells us that Mary Magdalene was the first to receive the news of the risen Christ. She was then instructed to go and tell the disciples this word. They were locked away, afraid of what was going on, what they'd seen go down in Jerusalem. And so she breaks into their mourning with this amazing update. And then we're told what happens next is that they don't believe. They doubt what she's saying is true. Mark goes on to say that later that same day, Jesus encounters two of his followers on the road to Emmaus. Luke tells us that story in far greater detail. But what Mark contributes to this account is that when these two disciples go and try to tell the others about this encounter, they're met with the same response Mary got: disbelief. So I don't know if you're keeping score, but if you are, that means twice the disciples have been told Jesus is alive, and twice they've doubted. And apparently this was a pattern of sorts, because Luke says in Acts that during the 40 days after his crucifixion, Jesus appeared to the apostles from time to time and proved to them in many ways that he was actually alive. That would suggest that the apostles were struggling to believe what had happened for quite some time following the resurrection. And this wasn't just Thomas, right? This was the whole disciple gang. Matthew then adds a really intriguing bit for us to chew on this whole Easter theme of doubt. He tells us at the very end of his gospel that just before Jesus ascended to the Father, the disciples are gathered in Galilee. That's where Jesus told them to go. You'll remember at the Last Supper, he said, after the resurrection, meet me in Galilee. It's the place he told the women outside of the tomb to tell the guys to go. And so it's there, Matthew says, in Galilee, where the disciples saw Jesus and worshiped him. And yet, in spite of all that, he writes, some of them still doubted. Now, every one of these passages is loaded. And don't worry, we're not going to go through each one of them this morning. Phew. But what I hope that you're seeing now as we go back to John's gospel and back to our friend Thomas is that there was a whole lot of doubting going on in the days following the resurrection. John writes of several post-resurrection appearances that Jesus made to his followers. Two of them were mentioned in the reading we heard earlier. In the first, he says, Jesus appeared to 10 of the 11 remaining disciples. Guess who was missing? Thomas. And we don't know where Thomas was. We don't know if he was off grieving on his own or if Thomas had decided Jesus is gone, so it's time for me to get back to business. And he'd gone back to his previous vocation and habits from before his days of being a disciple. We don't know where Thomas was, but interestingly, even in his absence, John writes that still more doubt enters the story, this time in the form of fear. He says that the disciples were gathered together behind locked doors for fear of the Jewish leaders and what was yet to come. They were no longer certain that Jesus was who he said he was. They no longer knew if he was the Messiah, the one who would bring the kingdom of God to earth, who would bring justice and mercy to Israel. After all, they'd just seen him die with their own eyes. And while they'd heard these accounts of the empty tomb and of people encountering a risen Christ, they were pressing dangerous realities, realities that they could see and feel that were closing in all around them. So no matter how much they might have wanted to believe that these stories they were hearing were true, their hiding in locked quarters demonstrated the depths of the doubt that was setting in. This makes me think that it would be far more appropriate for us to call this Doubting Disciple Sunday, don't you think? Because the truth is, we don't really know a whole lot about Thomas. The Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, actually tell us virtually nothing. They only list Thomas as one of the apostles, nothing more. John is our primary informant where Thomas is concerned. And it's curious to me that while the other gospel writers recorded the general doubts of the disciples in their stories, John tells us the explicit details of Thomas's inability to accept the other's testimony of the resurrected Christ. I won't believe it, Thomas says, unless I see the nail wounds in his hands, put my fingers into them, and place my hands into the wounds in his side. I'm thinking, why not audacious Thomas? Daring Thomas. Give it to me straight, Thomas. Can you imagine the fun, liturgically speaking, of Daring Thomas Sunday? Be awesome. Clearly, this is where Doubting Thomas gets his title. But it all feels a little overblown to me because Thomas is just asking for the same kind of evidence everyone else is at this point in the story in order to believe. Granted, he might have been pushing the envelope a little with that whole stick my hands into his wounds thing. I think Thomas was a bit of a dramatic. But after everything he had been privy to for the past 3 years, heck, for the past 2 weeks, wasn't his need to touch Jesus, to hold on to his resurrected body, understandable at this point? Clearly, doubt was writ large over this whole post-resurrection situation. And Thomas is just one of many who was trying to sort through what had happened, what was true, what was going to happen now. So I'm curious, what about Thomas's story was something John felt needed to be recorded in detail for us to consider thousands of years later? And as I've read this account over and over again this past week, there are two responses here that stand out to me as significant. The first is Jesus's response to Thomas. How Jesus-like is it that he would appear again, just as he had 1 week before to the disciples for the benefit of the guy who'd missed out? Luke writes that when Jesus met with the 10 on the evening of the resurrection, he showed them his wounded hands and feet. That's why Thomas was asking for the same kind of evidence. He wasn't pulling this request out of thin air. And sure enough, a week later, as if representing the entire scene for Thomas's benefit, Jesus delivers. He goes so far as to say, "Hey, Thomas, bring your finger over here." Really, as I understand it, that's a pretty good interpretation of the Greek. Bring your finger over here. And he offers him his oozy wounds to inspect as evidence that he's really there in physical form. I like to think Jesus could hang with Thomas's flair for the dramatic. This beautiful exchange, this beautiful extension of grace and hospitality that Jesus offers here to Thomas understands the limits of his faith, and it meets his need for evidence in this incredibly difficult and confusing time. It's significant to me that Jesus isn't put off by Thomas's doubt. He doesn't shame him. He doesn't punish him for his lack of faith. Instead, he invites Thomas, "Come closer." Doubts and all, recognizing, as Kierkegaard once wrote, that only he who doubts can truly believe. If you've ever walked through a season of doubt in your own journey of faith, had a dark night of the soul, if you will, then you recognize just how this invitation must have felt to Thomas. Because in seasons where the questions creep in and they relentlessly linger, and you feel so uncertain about things that you once felt so sure of, I think it's almost instinctive for us to put on a shroud of shame, to feel that we must be doing something wrong because somehow the answers we've had for so long now suddenly don't seem to add up. The faith that we once clung to no longer seems sufficient. And in these seasons, the temptation really is to isolate, to separate ourselves from one another and from Jesus himself, either fearful that our doubts will be discovered or that we will be deemed unworthy to be part of the family of faith anymore. But we see here that Jesus knows of Thomas's doubt, and instead of pulling away, he says, "Welcome, friend. Come closer. As close as you can, I'm staying right here." This reception from Jesus then naturally demands a response from Thomas, and I think we should pay attention to that response as well. Caravaggio and many other famous artists have portrayed renderings of this encounter. I'm talking countless images and renderings of this moment that imagine Thomas taking Jesus up on his offer. And I don't mean to burst anybody's bubble here, but we don't actually know if this happened. I mean, John's first letter, we heard a portion of it earlier, would indicate that at some point, the disciples did in fact touch, hold on to the resurrected Jesus's body. But in this particular moment, this instance where Jesus invites Thomas to come, and we don't really know if this happened. What we do know from John's account is that in this moment of receiving this invitation from Christ, Thomas makes what is known as the highest confession of faith in all the Gospels. He says, "My Lord and my God." Lord is something that a lot of people would have called Jesus by this point in the story, Master. But Thomas was the first to proclaim Jesus was God, to testify to his authority and his divinity. And in this statement of faith, Thomas affirms his understanding, his belief that yes, Jesus is alive, in flesh, victorious over sin, death, and hell, and standing right there alongside him. I can't tell you how many times I've read John chapter 20 and merely thought of it as the story of doubting Thomas. But I think if we understand how prevalent doubt was surrounding the events of Jesus's death and resurrection, especially from the perspective of the other gospel writers, then I have to wonder what else we might glean from John's detailed description of this encounter between Jesus and Thomas. I wonder if we'd see the power of Thomas's honesty in this story. It's been said that the opposite of faith is not doubt, but certainty. In other words, to have faith is to have questions. The two go hand in hand. But what's beautiful to me about Thomas's story especially is the way his doubts are brought forth within community. He honestly tells his fellow disciples, his community of faith, I hear your testimony, guys, and I'm sure you believe that you've seen a risen Jesus, but I haven't. I'm not there yet. And for me, this is the part of Thomas's doubt that's refreshing, because far worse than a doubting Thomas would be a pretending Thomas. He doesn't hide his lack of faith from his friends. He wasn't just going along with their experience in order to feel included. He honestly shares his struggle and trusts his community ability to hold it and to hold him in this incredibly trying time. I think far too often people step away from faith because they've sat alone with their doubts for so long. They're either afraid their communities can't accept their questions, so they hide them, or they lean solely on their own understandings of God. They never allow the greater community's experience with God to inform and influence who they understand him to be. Either way, what ultimately drives them away from Jesus is their inability to handle their doubt alone. And so I think Thomas's honesty here reminds us that we need others in our journeys of faith. I also wonder if we read this as more than just the account of doubting Thomas. I wonder if we'd see and heed Jesus's example of radical hospitality, his call to welcome those who are still struggling to believe that Jesus is alive. I don't like to say this, but I often feel like the church is perceived as a place just for those who believe. We'd never say that publicly. But when questions arise that feel testing or unorthodox, Christians can often respond like it's an affront to our faith instead of an opportunity for us to walk alongside those who are still searching for Jesus. And friends, when defense is our mindset, anger and anxiety typically emerge as polarizing responses to doubt. We either become uncomfortable with the difficult questions that doubt delivers, or we feel like we have to defend Jesus with our answer arrows, shooting them at those who come asking questions. Jesus didn't engage Thomas with chastisement or disappointment. He didn't give him a pop quiz about everything that he should know after having followed him for 3 years. He gave Thomas his wounded flesh, arguably the most human part of himself, but also arguably the part of a risen Jesus that still would have been really hard to comprehend. And I think Jesus' response to Thomas here reminds us that knowing more rarely eases doubt, but increased trust often can. But that trust comes not when we are more winsome or when we have more right answers. Instead, it comes when we remain present, when we welcome someone's difficult questions, maybe even share some of our own, inviting deeper engagement so that the Holy Spirit can be revealed in us over time. As I read this story again and again this week, I was reminded of another story. A story about a boy who went out on a fine day to fly his kite. It was the perfect occasion to do this. The wind was brisk and there were large billowy clouds in the sky. And the kite went higher and higher to the boy's delight until finally it was so high that it was completely hidden behind one of those large fluffy clouds. About that time, a man walked by the boy who was standing in the street holding his kite string. And the man said to the child, "What are you doing?" The kid said, "Flying a kite." The man said, "Really? But how can you be sure? You can't even see the kite. And the boy responded, no, I can't see it. But every now and again, I feel a tug. And I'm reminded it's there. What if our doubts are the tugs on the kite strings of our faith that every now and then remind us to re-engage, to ask questions, to pay attention, and that call us, as difficult as it might be, to once again trust in what is true? What if John included this story in his gospel not to make an example of someone who doubted, but to help those of us who would hear the story of Jesus thousands of years later understand that faith is not easy. It's downright difficult in many seasons and situations. If it was a struggle for those who stood right there with the risen Christ, how much more difficult is it for us today? Jesus said to Thomas, you believe because you have seen me. Blessed are those who believe without seeing. And so I would imagine that there are some of those of us here today who, like Thomas, need to honestly express our doubts to God and maybe to one another. We need to stop pretending that we get it all and receive the assurance Christ offers us to come, doubts and all, and trust that there is room for you and your questions and your uncertainties. To embrace those tugs on the strings of your faith as opportunities for formation and growth. Others of us may need to make room for the people around us who are experiencing seasons of doubt. Maybe you have friends or loved ones who have become skeptical of what they once believed, become skeptical of what you believe. And the temptation is to grow worried about them or to feel frustrated by their questions and to grow impatient with their process. The story of Thomas reminds us that we have to surrender that desire to hurry them up, get them through this phase, if you will, or to hurl answers at their questions and just sit with them in the dark night of their soul. I was reminded of this just this past week as I sat with a friend who is in the process of making her way through a dark night of the soul. And she told me that she's making it through this season by entrusting her doubts to the faith of others in her life. As she said it, I realized that, like Thomas, this friend is in the process of being resurrected with Jesus. What feels dead inside of her has honestly been confronted and is being entrusted to the faith of others who will sustain and fortify her in this time. The questions that feel too large for answers are now being held in community, not pushed away, not avoided, just held as an entrustment and as that which holds potential for the new life that is yet to come. So I think we sustain the enthusiasm of Easter when we enter the story of God in its fullness, not just the highlights, but when we enter all the cracks and crevices, trusting that in so doing, we are being resurrected with Jesus and living into the day of the Lord as Easter people.